Blog Talk Radio.
What's Happening, Blog Talk Radio. And tonight is Tuesday, September the 28th, 2021. And tonight, our theme is about the great gambles. The gambles of COVID. The gambles of the public school system. The gambles of the immigration / migration issues. And so we are always dealing with an anatomy of oppression. And we say that colonialism is oppression. And colonialism is really American capitalism. So without further ado, Brother Ralph, your mic is open.
Good evening, my brothers and sisters. Glad to be back after our long hiatus through the summer, and there is so much to talk about. And so let's get right to the subject. The great gambles. Why are these issues gambles? COVID, schools, immigration, migration, and let's go further. Tax. Who's paying the tax and who's spending it? Let's add more. Department of Agriculture, what are we eating? Is it going to kill us? The Department of Water, what are we drinking? Will it kill us? Voting rights, housing regulations, and we could go on and on. Now, why is it a gamble? Because there's no one to be trusted. Who you gonna trust? Who you gonna call? We have all of these problems, but there's no one to look to solve them. They have proven it. Who will you trust with your life? And here we are with COVID, and you gotta trust somebody. Are you gonna trust your local doctor? Are you gonna trust Fauci? Are you gonna trust anything the government says? And that reminds me, a long, long time ago when we started this program, I said, what we are going to try to do here is solve a basic problem. And to define the problem, I went to a story by Jack London. No, I'm not a fan of Jack London other than he wrote very well. He was anti-Jack Johnson, which is a terrible thing, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about a scene when he talks about in the far north in Alaska, and he talks about getting to a town, Nome, I believe it was. He describes the weather, and he goes to the barbershop. And in that barbershop, he notices there's a sign. And he says, that sign says more about what's happening than anything else. And the sign in the back of the barbershop was, no trust. Well, here we are, and this is not a story. This is not Nome, Alaska. It's not going to be a happy ending. But we are in a situation that has been growing and growing and growing. And that is a question of trust, because those that we trusted have not told us the truth. We're going to trust the government about war? Please, Afghanistan, they said they didn't know it was going to collapse as quick as it did. Well, what happened in Vietnam? Where were they? Did they not understand that when you buy people, you may buy them for a little while, but the question is, how long are they going to stay bought? Karzai wasn't bought for very long. He was bought as long as it was profitable, and I'm wondering how the plane got off the ground with the amount of cash that he had with him. And if you look back at Vietnam, the same story. How are they going to get out of there? They were first to run, those who were paid, and they left others. This is the history of buying people, not just in Vietnam, not just in Afghanistan, but the history of empire. No people can be oppressed without the connivance of their own. So in empire, you buy their own. But how long does it last? And so back to the issue that we are confronted with right today. And it's about our lives. But it's been about our lives for a long time. The food we eat, the Food and Drug Administration, the Department of Agriculture. Who do we trust? And should we trust them? And so we'll have a lot of folks telling us about what they're thinking about the situation we're in. And we're not limited to COVID. And so whatever subject you have that you think that we should hear about, and we have special guests to talk about very serious subjects, and most of them are going to boil down to who you're going to trust. And back to Sister Betty to give us how we start our program. You can trust our program to work towards giving you the truth. You can trust our program, the format, for a little while anyway, when we honor the poets. And I don't want to tell you what was said about the poets by some of the Greek philosophers who said they say it very well, but they don't know what they're saying. But we have poets who say it very well, and they know exactly what they're saying. Sister Betty.
Thank you, Brother Ralph. So without further ado, we're going to go straight to our revolutionary liberation poetry, and our sister Nzinga is in the house. And I want you to know we have a lineup of people who not only know the problem, but they have some ideas about the solution. We're not just crying, woe is me. We're not wringing our hands like liberals saying there is no solution. There is a solution, and that's what we are about on this blog. Sister Nzinga, your mic is open, and thank you.
Yes, good evening. Thank you again, Sister Betty, Brother Ralph, for having me again. So I was supposed to do a poem as a tribute to the sister that transitioned. So I'm going to honor her tonight with that poem. And the title of the poem is She Is. She is an image of desirable beauty and a pleasure to be around. You can find her holding it down as a corporate exec or on the front line fighting against years of injustice and economic neglect. She is of the family that no one can deny. Her purpose and her worth must never be minimized, for she is too valuable a being for it to be compromised. She is a symbol of love, strength, and honor. And with all the indignities inflicted upon her, still she rises and moves forward grandly. For she is a queen who represents nobility, who embraces and accepts her status of royalty. She is a suffragette, tirelessly during a time of racial hatred and racial divide for rights that she was not even granted until long after the words she chanted in a movement that helped bring about the 19th Amendment. She is sophisticated, educated, elegant, and intelligent, sassy, classy, cultured, and refined, the lifeline to all mankind, the creator's divine design. She is Aretha Franklin, melodically calling for a little respect, often confused, abused, and misused, a natural woman who many doubt, whose many contributions are far too often forgotten about. She is Hidden Figures, and Oprah Winfrey, Coretta Scott King, and Betty Shabazz, Toni Morrison, and Nikki Giovanni, Maya Angelou, and all that jazz. She is Akua Ndiri and Angela Davis, Frances Cress Welsings and Sister Soldier, Eleanor Bumpers and Sandra Bland, Erykah Badu and Chaka Khan, every woman fighting for freedom for the black man and the black woman. I am so privileged to walk in the path of these royal highnesses who paved the way for the endless possibilities women can imagine today. And I am proud to say I walk the path with grace and pride. For who she is, so am I. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much. And it seems to me she is woman. And as I think it was Mao Zedong says, women hold up half the sky. And so we better recognize that, because maybe they hold up more than half of the sky. Maybe we, the men, are shortchanging the people who do to the work. And without further ado, we are going to go right to our guest, Sister Betty.
I want to thank Sister Nzinga again. She is a major warrior in trying to fight for our African burial ground in Brooklyn, on the corner of Church and Bedford Avenue. And she has tirelessly supported political prisoners. And her generation makes me smile. I want to really acknowledge her energy and her devotion to our community. Without further ado, I want to ask everyone to have a moment of silence for Brother Chuck Africa. We lost another warrior. And there's a Southern song, Another Man Done Gone. He had a long chain on. Another man done gone. Thank you. Without further ado, we're going to open up our mic for our comrade Don Fitz. And Don Fitz is on the editorial board of the Green Social Thought. His book, Human Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution, is forthcoming. And he's going to talk to us tonight about healthcare. I want to talk about some aspects of a third party that I like. One of the things I like about a third party such as the Green Party is the fact that they called an emergency Zoom the other night, the National Black Caucus of the Green Party. Like we said, red, black, and green, those are good colors. And it was to address the Holocaust that is taking place in Haiti and to try and to call for a national day of protest and support of our comrades and sisters and brothers in Haiti. I am so proud of them. I will be giving you updates. And as many of you know, when the hurricane happened, the earthquake happened 10 years ago, it was the Green Party that organized protests at every single Red Cross station for their neglect of the people of Haiti, just like they neglected us during Hurricane Katrina. But more of that later. Don, your mic is open, and welcome.
Don Fitz, your mic is open.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't. Yeah.
Don Fitz, go ahead.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes, we hear you.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, I want to thank Ralph and Betty for inviting me. It's really an honor to be on the show. I loved the introduction about trust, because trusting the medical system in Cuba and trusting the medical system in the United States is core. And I want to follow up on what Sister Betty said about Katrina. Let's not forget that Cuba had 1,500 healthcare workers packed and ready to go on the spot to New Orleans. And George W. Bush, in fact, said that we would rather black people in New Orleans die than admit that Cuba can coordinate medical relief better than the United States can in its own country. And let me back up just a little bit what I was going to say. First thing I want to mention, and then in Cuba, the core of the health system is the consultorio, the doctor's office, doctor-nurse teams in every neighborhood in Cuba. And if anybody who lives in an urban area in Cuba, in a city or town, is within walking distance of a doctor's office, and the doctors do, in fact, walk to people's homes. Another thing about Cuban medicine that a lot of people do not know is that Cuba has developed an incredible amount of vaccines and vaccinated large number of people for decades, more than any other poor countries, including vaccinating the childhood population for polio, type B meningitis, measles, mumps, rubella, not only providing health care for the Cuban people, but for people throughout the world. Cuba sends its doctors and medical staff across the country. By 2008, they had treated 70 million people in 154 countries. Now, I would guess that it has at least doubled the treating 140 to 150 million people. What did the U.S. do in response to Cuba sending so many of its own doctors abroad? George W. Bush in 2006 started what he called the Cuban Medical Professional Parole Program, where they were tried to woo Cuban doctors away from Cuba, who were on medical missions throughout the world, and allow them to come into the United States with no questions asked to practice medicine at a much, much higher rate of pay. And of 40,000 Cuban medical staff working abroad, 500, that's only slightly over 1%, agreed to do that and defect. But those 500 were 500 medical staff who were no longer able to give medical care to people in the Caribbean, Latin America, and Africa. The sanctions that the U.S. has imposed on Cuba continue. They were started during the special period after the Soviet Union fell. The worst was added by Trump, who added about 230 to 250 new sanctions. And Biden had promised he would have a new page open for Cuba, but he hasn't lifted any of the sanctions that Trump set up, and he's added new sanctions. And let's not remember that the first president who really confronted Cuba, who hated Cuba intensely, was John F. Kennedy, a Democrat. And today there's four U.S. politicians who lead the hate campaign against Cuba. You probably recognize Marco Rubio from Florida, but who's a Republican, but also Democratic Senator Bob Menendez is leading the hatred against Cuba. Okay, what I was talking about was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, which had a devastating effect on Cuba. It meant that the $4 to $5 billion annual subsidy ended because there was no Soviet Union, and Cuba was shaken so much that its economy shrank by 45% within the next few years. That's bigger than any other country that I know of, an economic shrink, except during war when the country's totally devastated. It was basically an economic war of the United States against Cuba. So how did Cuba survive during this period? Cuba reduced rations for food, reduced all sorts of things, reduced output. There's two areas that Cuba did not reduce at all, and those two areas were education and medicine. And as a result of Cuba continuing to do work on lowering infant mortality, at the beginning of the special period in the year 1990, Cuba had a higher infant mortality than the U.S. But at the end of the special period in the year 2000, Cuba had a lower infant mortality rate than the U.S. You find almost a mirror image in life expectancy. At the beginning of the special period in 1990, Cuba had a shorter life expectancy than the U.S. By the end, in 2000, Cuba had a longer life expectancy, showing that Cuba's nationalized system was one that was really based on winning the trust of the people. The AIDS epidemic hit Cuba in 1986. I'm sure everybody remembers AIDS arriving in the 1980s. New York City has about the same population as Cuba. At one time in the AIDS epidemic, Cuba had 200 AIDS cases. At the same time, New York City had about 43,000 cases. Again, Cuba having a much superior response than the United States. Coronavirus hit at the end of 2019 and actually the beginning of 2020. And Cuba's MINSEP, that's the abbreviation for their medical center, the Coordination of Medical Services, Department of Medicine. They immediately developed a national plan. If you remember when COVID first hit the United States, there was no concept of a unified national plan. In Cuba, there's no concept of having every province or state have its own policy, and every city within every province having a different policy, and the school systems having a different policy. Cuba developed a single policy for the entire nation. I mentioned the doctor's offices, the consultorio. Every doctor's office has medical students assigned to it. As COVID hit, every medical student assigned to a doctor's office had a number of people that they went to look after the people to see what they needed to survive. And it was not like the United States where people go to the medical agencies. In Cuba, the medical agencies, beginning with the doctor's offices, went to the people. If you remember back to April of 2020, there was a big uproar in the United States because of the inability to provide protective personal equipment for all sorts of medical staff. At Cuba, since they had a unified national policy, they immediately switched factories from making uniforms for school into making masks for people so that everybody could have a mask. Cuba went beyond that and provided, as it was providing help for its own people, it provided help for others. And March of 2020 is a very important month because the epicenter of COVID in Europe was Italy. Cuba sent 52 doctors and nurses to Italy to help the most devastated area of Italy. It was the first time that I know of a poor Caribbean country sending doctors to a rich European country because they could take better care of people. And the same month, the British cruise ship Braemar had a phenomenal event happen. They had 50 people out of 1,000 on board came down with COVID symptoms. The Bahamas and the Barbados would not let the Braemar dock there, even though it was a British ship and they were part of the British Commonwealth. The only place in the Caribbean that would allow the ship Braemar to dock was Cuba, which immediately took the people off the ship and provided treatment because the doctors were confident that they could handle the COVID crisis. So how did the U.S. respond to this? I think people know how important remittances are. If somebody is a Haitian is in the United States and earns money, that person's very likely to send a lot of the money back to the relatives in Haiti. The same thing has been true of Cuba. Trump ended remittances of Cubans living in the United States. They can no longer send them to Cuba. Joe Biden has continued this policies, and this is making life very, very hard on Cuban people. So how has Cuba responded? Cuba has been the only poor country in the world to develop its own multiple vaccines against COVID. Another month which will be remembered is September 2021, which we're in the middle of right now. There's a lot of discussion about the possibility of the U.S. vaccinating children under 12 years of age. On September 2nd, Cuba became the first country in the world to vaccinate children of 2 to 11 years of age. So how has this played out in terms of deaths in the United States and Cuba? I had to do some research on that, but if you look at deaths per 100,000 people, in Cuba it's like a little over 0.5 deaths per 100,000 people from COVID. In the United States, it's 1.99 per 100,000 people, or slightly under 2.0. The United States has almost four times as many deaths from COVID as the United States. I want to mention something about Cuba before the revolution, which people virtually never talk about. There was virtual civil war within the medical associations. About half of the doctors wanted to just become rich and make as much money as they could off of medicine and could not imagine going to the poor areas of Cuba, which were overwhelmingly rural, overwhelmingly black. The progressive doctors wanted to provide care to as many people as they could, and they wanted to change national policy towards a national health care system, which would provide health care to rural Cuba. And so this indicates something critically important for us in fighting for health care now. The doctors who stayed in Cuba, half of the doctors left within 2 or 3 years after the revolution. They went to Miami. But half of the doctors stayed, and they completely transformed the health care system. So what does this teach us about Medicare for All? Medicare for All is not the end point of changing the U.S. health care system. Health care for All is the beginning point for a total transformation of the healthcare system. And just as in Cuba before the revolution, there were many doctors who were providing medicine to poor people, even though there was not support for that from the Cuban government. Right now, there are groups that are providing medical care to people in the U.S. in an organized way. One is Catherine Hall Trujillo, who has started the Birthing Project. She noticed that a lot of black infants were not adequately cared for during the first year of life. So what the Birthing Project does is to pair up women who have birthing experience with black women who have trouble with their infants during the first year of life, and they teach them everything to childbirth classes through providing care during the first year of life. Catherine Hull Trujillo has taken in several people who are Americans who were trained in Cuba to how to provide medical care. And in a 2018 interview, she told me we're a coming home place for the students from Cuba because here they can find what they were trained to do. Just last year, there was another incident. When COVID hit really hard, a Cuban doctor, an American who graduated from medical school in Cuba, was Dr. Melissa Barber. And she looked around her neighborhood, and what she found was that people in her neighborhood didn't know. They were told to go to the healthcare system. She said, in Cuba, I learned how the healthcare system goes to the people. So she worked with South Bronx Unite, Mount Haven Mamas, and multiple tenant organizations to find medical staff and other people who would go to people in the neighborhood to see what their needs were. A couple of statistics I want to bring up as I'm closing out. During the COVID years, in the year of 2020, America experienced the largest decline in life expectancy than it has for a long time. It was 1 year decline, the greatest since World War II. But for Black Americans and Hispanic Americans, it was 3 years. And Black life expectancy has not fallen so much in 1 year since the Great Depression. It's common knowledge that a lot of Black people are very reluctant to trust the government to provide medical care and very reluctant to trust the medical system because of how they've been treated by the medical system. And so as a result, a lot of people refuse to get vaccination. I want to point out something very critical about the Cuban Revolution. It happened in 1959. In 1960s, Black people throughout rural and urban Cuba were seeing clinics and medical care being provided to Black people for the first time in their lives. Many had never seen a doctor before. At the same time this medical care was being given to Black communities for the first time, Cubans could watch Black people in the United States being beaten and having dogs sicked on them for the crime of wanting to sit down at a whites-only lunch counter. That's why there is such an enormous difference of trust in the United States and Cuba. And the last thing I want to mention is that Cuba achieves better outcome for the U.S. in terms of life expectancy and infant mortality. Cuba spends less than 10% per person per year of what the U.S. does. It's not a question of not having enough money for medical care. There's actually vastly more than enough money for medical care. The problem is that the money is spent to make every life, every insurance company, every medical establishment, every drug company as rich as they possibly can instead of giving care to the people who need it. That's the critical difference between the Cuban medical system and the U.S. medical system. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so very much, Don Fitz. As we talk about this program, education, 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 information plus activity, information leading to activity. And I'm sure, Don Fitz, that your information is going to lead many of the people who are listening here to join the defense of Cuba, to talk to their congressmen, to the people who are supposedly representing us, to tell the government, Mr. Biden, who says he's going to change things, hurry up, get to the change. But it's the first thing we have to do is deal with what's hurting us now. And so thanks again, Don Fitz. Name us your book so we can keep that information.
Okay, if you want a copy, you can just Google this title, Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution. And that will take you to Monthly Review. Please buy it from Monthly Review and not Amazon.com. And if you want a signed copy, get in touch with Ralph or Betty because they have my phone number, and you can get a signed copy from me for the same price it would cost you for Monthly Review.
Okay, repeat that once again. Cuban Healthcare.
Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution.
Thank you so much, and we look forward to having you back. Sister Betty.
Yes, Brother Don, the last time you were on, you talked about the fallacy of these so-called Save the Planet scams that are out there. And we hope or soon you'll come back and review that topic with us again, because so many people are being hoodwinked, thinking they're saving the planet, and it costs as much as...
The solution is as bad as the problem. The solution's being suggested. And so thanks again. We look to see you again and to update us on that subject because it is sorely needed. Sister Betty.
Okay.
And remember what John said. You don't call us for your copy of the book. Don't get it from Amazon, whatever you do. Don, you want to have a few more parting words?
Well, I think that's it. I just... You know, I can't overemphasize the fact that Cuba had a revolutionary movement in medicine before the revolution, and then that allowed the explosion of the revolutionary struggle after the revolution. And so improving medicine is not a one-step thing like we get Medicare for all and we've won. It's an ongoing process of developing better new ways to develop better medical care.
Thanks again for that message and encouragement, and we're going to move on knowing that you're coming back and to give us more information that should lead, that must lead to activity. Sister Betty.
All right, we're going to keep the momentum going. Brother Henry is back, Brother Henry Hagen, a fighter for justice, a fighter for political prisoners, in particular, Mia Abu-Jamal. Brother Henry, what have you got for us today?
Thank you for this opportunity. I just wanted to thank your guest, Don Fritz. He spoke great truths and accuracies, and what the Cubans are doing, not only in this hemisphere, but around the world, is very positive, in spite of the horrible stories and practices by the United States against that valiant people. I want to share with folks tonight two things. One is that... Curtis Blow wrote an article, or released an article yesterday, entitled "Biden Has Stabbed His Black Supporters in the Back." I'm not sure what the publication is, but you can get it online. But I think it has merit, and it's worth reading. He's very critical of how, you know, we've been treated in general politically by these politicians who always pretend to be our friends. The other thing is that I like to refer to a poem tonight entitled "Reign of a Human Race." And it's not the natural reign, but this is the reign that talks about government. And it's by Paul LaRocque. It comes out of a book published by Workers' World some years ago entitled "Haiti, a Slave Revolution, 200 Years After 1804. And I'd like to begin and share it with the audience. It was written by Paul LaRocque, translation from the French by Rosemary Mano. You say democracy, and we say that it's tin from Bolivia, copper from Chile, petroleum from Venezuela, sugar from Cuba, raw materials and profits. You say democracy, and it's the annexation of Texas, the holdup of the Panama Canal, the occupation of Haiti, the colonization of Puerto Rico, the bombing of Guatemala. You say democracy, and it's America to the Yankee. It's the rape of nations. It's Sandino's blood, Peralta's crucifixion. You say democracy, and it's the plunder of our wealth from Hiroshima to Indochina. You spread the slaughter everywhere, and everywhere ruin. You say democracy, and it's the Ku Klux Klan of hidden people inside your own cities. An ogre is devouring your children. Ubu, from the empire of robots, you let ravens fly. From Harlem to Jerusalem, from Wounded Knee to Haiti, from Santo Domingo to Soweto, the people will be waving the torch of revolution. Night is a tunnel opening on the dawn. Vietnam stands like a tree in the storm. The frontier which marks the place of your defeat, history's lessons have no recourse. A footbridge stretches from Asia to Africa. The reign of the white race is ending on Earth, and the reign of the people in the universe is beginning.
Whoa. Thank you. Thank you. Understand and I can't say it too many times. Information must lead to activity. We must act on the emotion that we are feeling when we hear these speakers tell us what is real in this society. Sister Betty.
And I want to emphasize, everybody that's on this call is an activist. And so they make a sacrifice. It's like, you know, the judge who said to the two women who claimed this child, you know, well, shall we cut the baby in half? Some activists actually feel that's what they're doing. But they sacrifice to get on here because they want our community to be enlightened. And I really appreciate people like Don Fitz and Henry Hagen for getting on and sharing their insights and their enlightenment with us. That's the only way we're going to win this battle against metaphysical imperialism. I want to continue. Want you to know we extended the time, and I appreciate that everybody is cognizant of the fact that people have very important things to say. Sister Dolores, we missed you last week. Your mic is open.
Oh, hi, everyone, and thanks for that Cuba report. Thanks so much. I was reading the New York Times this Sunday and in the health section, and there's an article there entitled A Race-Free Approach to Diagnosing Kidney Disease. A scientific task force has been called for abandoning a common measure of kidney function that adjusts results by race, providing different assessments for black patients than for others. The adjustment may make black patients seem less ill than they really are, according to many experts. Instead, doctors should rely on a race-neutral method for diagnosing and managing kidney disease, concluded a report from the National Kidney Foundation and the American Society of Nephrology. The study was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And by one estimate, it states that 1 million black Americans might be treated earlier for kidney disease if the diagnostic equation were not adjusted for race. The task force report comes amid a national reckoning over racial health disparities spurred by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has taken a disproportionate toll on people of color and has highlighted the excessive burdens of chronic disease in those communities. This is a moral issue, says the San Francisco doctor. It is time to remove race from the equation. Black and Hispanic Americans have long suffered from high rates of conditions such as diabetes, high blood pressure, and obesity, which can exacerbate a bout of COVID. These factors can also increase the risk of developing kidney disease. The racial disparities in kidney disease are stark and well documented. Black Americans are more than 3 times as likely as white Americans to experience kidney failure and require dialysis or a kidney transplant. Black Americans make up only 13% of the population, yet they represent 35% of Americans with kidney failure. People of color and low-income Americans are less likely to receive good care when the first warning signs appear and chronic kidney disease could be prevented. They are more likely to progress to kidney failure and to require dialysis and less likely to be cared for by a kidney specialist before getting to that stage. The current measures used to assess kidney function may underestimate the severity of the illness in black patients, delaying referrals to specialists and making them less likely to be placed on waiting lists for a kidney transplant. Black mm-hmm. individuals Black individuals are inadvertently harmed because they are seen as not sick enough. The use of medical decision-making tools that take race and ethnicity into account is not unique to kidney disease. Doctors rely on to guide a diagnosis and treatment for many conditions, race and ethnicity, from bone density and kidney stones to cancer and pulmonary function tests, which include race as a variable. Race is a social construct and not a biological one. says the doctor, who's the associate chief of the renal division of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. It may be serving as a proxy for other risk factors, including food insecurity, housing insecurity, socioeconomic deprivation, all of which can limit access to the best healthcare practices. In recent months, several medical societies have taken steps to address the potential bias. The new report that reassessed the inclusion of race in the diagnosis of kidney disease was issued after a year of work and no small degree of controversy along the way. The kidney filter toxins from the blood. The new report recommends using a new equation to estimate the filtration rate using a blood test that measures levels of creatinine, a waste product made by the muscles kept in check when the kidneys are functioning properly. A related study just published in the New England Journal of Medicine and cited in this report developed and evaluated new diagnostic methods that do not include race as a variable. Race is a social construct and not a biological one. So I'll end it there.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for that, Dolores. As we say, education, we're being educated, and how are we going to go to a society and say, trust the government to give you a vaccine that's going to cure you, given that government's history? And I say, it's a gamble. We gamble on these situations that should be dealt with confidence. You need to have confidence, and there is no confidence for good reason in the American medical system, as we have just heard in our report from Don Fitz. And so I have had the vaccine twice, the Pfizer. And I knew from the jump it was a gamble. And we're gambling on too many things because we have not solved the problem. Sister Betty, next.
I again want to thank Brother Don Fitz, because if you put what Dolores just said within the context and the contrast of what's going on in Cuba, you realize we've got to have a revolution. Thank you, Sister Dolores. Welcome back. I want to get to Brother Tom, we've missed him, but before we do that, I see 8169. We're going to give you a few moments. 8169, last four digits. Your mic is open.
Peace and Black Power. I'm just sitting here listening, and I love the poems and the books that everybody is reading. I love the power and energy that we have in here. I feel the energy of the ancestors. So I am Queen Mother Kashiba. Try to be up here every Tuesday to listen to y'all. So y'all got a very powerful show. Brother Dennis, no, turn me on to y'all show. So I love it. And we continue. Black Power and Uhuru.
Thank you. Thank you.
Freedom, Uhuru. Sister Betty.
Brother Comrade Tom, your mic is open.
Thank you very much. I was able to go to Cuba during the special period when that was during the Clinton administration. A group of us teachers were able to go. The Soviet Union was disintegrating and had withdrawn its subsidies to the Cuban economy. What we expected to see was a country in an economic and social crisis, but we did not see this. Instead, we visited schools, and we also visited healthcare centers, and we found We didn't see anybody begging on the streets. We didn't see anybody homeless. Everything was rationed, but nobody was starving. And this country and that and Cuba was able to maintain the best health care and educational system in Latin America. That's what we saw. Well, right now, I myself am going through the meat grinder of our health care system. Gone are the days when you can call a doctor directly and make an appointment to see your doctor. Almost all of these doctors are connected with one of these mega hospitals, and you have to go through them first in order to make an appointment. Well, I was avoiding going to the doctor for quite a while, and finally I was able to contact my general practitioner who's connected with Mount Sinai, and he gave me a complete physical, and he recommended that I see a urologist. I have a serious prostate problem, and a cardiologist. I have also a irregular heartbeat and a leaky valve. I've known about these things. This is nothing new. I've been going to these doctors, and what did the urologist say? I asked him if he could determine whether I had prostate cancer or not. His answer was, doesn't make any difference whether you have prostate cancer or not. The overwhelming majority of men over the age of 70 have prostate cancer, but you'll die of something else. That was his approach to prostate cancer. Then I went to the cardiologist, and he gave me an echocardiogram and also put me on a heart monitor. And yesterday I went to see him, and he said that what I knew already, that I had these conditions. And I asked him, are these conditions that I have life-threatening? Are they worse than they were when I had similar exams in the past? He didn't have any straight answer. What he wants to do is do a catheterization by putting a wire from my groin all the way up to my heart to maybe put stents in to clear out the arteries. So I said, well, I want to talk to my general practitioner again about this, because he never suggested such a thing. So we have a country here, the richest country in the world, which has one of the worst healthcare systems in the entire world. And it boils down to this. I call the kind of capitalism that we have in this country capitalism on steroids. Capitalism is incapable of solving any serious crisis. It's incapable of solving the climate crisis. It's incapable of solving the healthcare crisis because it's based upon profit, and unfortunately, most of the doctors are into this system are also concerned with very intrusive procedures that's based upon profit, and so what we need is people to realize that just take this vaccine thing. I refuse to get vaccinated. There are other ways of dealing with this COVID-19 virus. I get tested almost every week. The tests always come out negative. I was told that I have antibodies which give me a sort of a natural immunity, and I'm very careful. I practice all the protocols about social distancing and wearing masks, etc. However, people are being pitted against each other. Those people like myself, we're being pitted against those people who are vaccinated. Well, here in New York, they decided to open up the economy precipitously. Why did they do this? Why didn't they open it up little by little instead of all at once? Well, because the business community was losing a lot of money, and that's the most important thing to capitalism. And when this happened before, sure enough, there was a resurgence of the virus, and there's a resurgence of the virus now. And people like the unvaccinated are being blamed for it. People are being pitted against each other. We do not know what the long-term effects of these vaccines are. They are still in an experimental stage. And so what people have to realize is that unless we get rid of capitalism, and that requires a completely radical change in people's thinking, because people think that this is a democracy and all of that sort of thing. And unless people understand what capitalism is all about, and we get rid of capitalism, we're never going to be able to solve any of these existential crises. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Tom. It just shows that what you are talking about is more education. The government here is about profit, but profit does not help. As a matter of fact, that the distribution of profit makes it impossible to govern debt balance. How about debt crisis? We have all of it, not we. This government has most of the money in the world, and they cannot manage it. Thank you, Sister Betty.
I want to emphasize, I hope you can recall some of what the first speaker shared with us, that they didn't just transform their medical system. They transformed the way people related to the communists would call it, the modes of production. And the modes of production are the institutions that impact on you on your life. I do believe that's one of the modes of production. I cannot emphasize enough how Don Fitz phrased that. It wasn't just a few good doctors. That would have been liberalism. They transformed the way people read their world. And I want to hear more of you coming up with concrete actions that you are doing that are successful in making people change the way they look at their world. Before we go to Louisiana, we have a very serious crisis in that state that must be heard. I cannot skip Brother Joel and Sister Gwen. We're going to start with Gwen. We're going to go to one speaker from New Orleans, and then we'll come back to Joel and go to another speaker on New Orleans. And I hope you guys will hang in there with us. Sister Gwen, welcome back. We missed you.
Gwen, your mic is open.
Oh, okay. Hi, everybody. First, I want to thank everybody for speaking. And I want to thank Brother Tom for your very, very heartfelt words. Ralph, you started the show with trust. Who are you going to trust? And, you know, I think one of the modes that people love to trust is the media. And Hearst said that he didn't just want to tell you the news. He wanted to be the news. So he started an operation in his newspapers and media production of actually creating the news. And I think that we're really, really at the top of that right now. I think the media has changed drastically. It's a lockdown kind of a thing. And when you call places like WNYC, it's so heavily, heavily censored. And they're so heavily screened that you can't even get in there to answer a question. They'll put a question out there, and they would rather have nobody answer the question than have somebody call up and have an intelligent or challenging answer. And the same thing has happened to WBAI. I know for myself that as soon as I ran for the station board, I could no longer make any more telephone calls to WBAI. When I dial the number, it simply doesn't go through anymore. And I find that WBAI has also become very, very censored. And I wanted to go back to this thing on trust and tell you how perplexed I am that people who are on the left, the people that say they are revolutionary, we'd stoop down and bend down and do anything this government told them to do when it comes to this disease. And I find it shocking because it's come to the point where, as Tom pointed out, that we are being pitted against each other, but we're also just falling into it. I mean, nobody's even asking themselves, do you think it's a good idea that I speak this way in public? I've heard people on WBAI, I've heard David Rothenberg speak ill about people who will not take the vaccine, not just critical, but pretty nasty. There was another woman on that has a show about the law on Mondays. I forget her name. I think it's Margaret. But she was calling out people who would not take the vaccine, saying that if they went to nursing homes, they should be arrested. Now, people are losing their jobs over this. We are in a terrible economy. And when Biden took everybody off unemployment at the same time, it was a windfall for the employers because now they get to choose from thousands of people for these crappy jobs and pay them less money. And I know because I'm at that place right now. So we're really, really at a bad place if you're an employee, but you're in a wonderful place as an employer. And I want to tell people that the billionaires of this world made 15 times more money than they ever have in their entire careers during this pandemic. And all I'm asking you to do is to think critically about this pandemic the way you think critically about everything else, because people that are making tons of money here, there is a desire from people like Bill Gates to see what he calls a thinning out of the population by 15%, and there is a capacity to do it. The whole thing is worldwide and being maneuvered, and I would say that at this point in time, I wouldn't even go to your politicians because they don't have any power anymore. Where we used to have corporations that influence politicians, we really don't even have that anymore. We have politicians which are just out there as front men for these corporations. And many of the people that are the owners of these corporations are simply insane. They are insane. And their vision for the future of the planet is insane. So given the fact that We've been through the Tuskegee experiments. We've been through wars that wouldn't have existed unless we started them. We had 9/11 where the building magically fell down at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. World Trade Center 7 magically fell down. We hear fairy tales about how men that, you know, trained on prop planes exactly 7 times were able to maneuver gigantic airplanes into the World Trade Center at extremely high speeds. We hear that a whole building like the World Trade Center can come down at 2,800 degrees and that every single body in there is turned into dust, and that's all real. Buy it one bit. And I am not listening to crazy people on the right tell me about the reason why I should not take this vaccine. I am listening to a lot of qualified scientists and doctors, and they are out there. And they are out there, and they will not be heard because this media will not allow them to be heard. So you can only find them at certain places. And if you don't find them on WBAI, this is one thing that Gary Knoll is usually on BAI, and they usually let him have these doctors on. But a lot of times, if it's too much, they won't air that show that day. That's how censored BAI has become. So if it's too hot, they'll just let him air the show on his network, Progressive Radio Network. But it's gotten to be this upside-down picture for me. People that tell me that I should question the government all the time and ask myself questions about what their motivation is are now telling me, shut your eyes, roll your sleeve up, stick your arm out, and don't worry about it. Well, I'm worried about it. You see, I have an autistic nephew, and nobody worried about that either. And now that boy is 20 years old, and there's nowhere to go. He's at the end of his road. And this didn't happen until after he took a concoction of terrible vaccines when he was a baby, and all of a sudden his life was ruined at 6 months old for the rest of his life because he took some. My sister gave him a vaccine, which she trusted, because she trusts doctors as if they're God himself. And I think that people in our country need to stop trusting doctors as if they are gods. They are not gods. They are human beings, and many of them love money and they love capitalism, and they don't have your better interest at heart. Believe me, there are two systems here. There's a system for black people when they go to the hospitals, and there's a system for white people. Not a lot better for white people, I might add. But if you don't think that doctors are human, you're wrong. Doctors are human, and some of them are really great, and some of them are really bad. But I do know there's a lot of people here that are participating in messing with fire with this vaccine. And if you personally think that you are at risk and this is the only thing that's going to help you, I will never tell you to not take it. I would just ask you to respect my decision to not take that vaccine. Please don't call me names on the air. Please don't tell me I'm stupid. Tell me I'm mentally ill. Tell me I'm a Donald Trumper. Please don't say those things about me. I've been in the streets for my entire life. I've been an activist my entire life. I have paid the way through my blood, sweat, and tears. So don't turn around and smack me down as if you're sitting on your high horse and you know better. If you know so well, you don't know. So I just want to put these thoughts out there tonight for people to ponder over, because we are all here trying to struggle and make things better for everybody. And we only hurt ourselves when we act out against each other this way. And I'm really shocked and dismayed when I see people that I've known for years, people that I've heard on the radio for years, speak so ill of other people that it makes me want to just turn away from them. And it takes people like me and Tom and Joel, and it puts us in a weird place. We don't know where we are anymore because we have people that are on the left that are talking to us like we're a pariah, that say to us, we don't mind if they round you up and put you in camps. Understand, that's a real thing that could happen. Bill Gates was talking about that the other day. Bill Gates said publicly on CNN that he thought there should be somebody to come around and put us back in our place that's part of the government. What does that mean? You're going to start rounding us up and putting us in camps?
Well, I think you made your point. And
thank you.
Understand, we love you. We love your thoughts. We love what you're questioning. And we must all question what's going on because corporations do own the politicians and the media. So thanks again, Gwen. We're moving on to Sister Betty.
I want to thank Gwen for raising up the flag of the loyal opposition. If we start with the people who don't want vaccines today, who will they censor tomorrow? And
that's
the
right.
Whole idea of fake news is more and more real. especially since you see how they have censored our ability to be online. I want to open up the mic to the people from New Orleans, but I want to acknowledge that Sister Nelly is in the house and Brother Joel is in the house, and we need to hear from them. But we will definitely do this after New Orleans. We want to ask the people from New Orleans, since there's more than one speaker, to be cognizant of the fact that we have to have a report from Tom and Nelly. Your mic is open, Sister Belinda. I'm sorry, Joel and Nelly. Sister Belinda and I believe Sister Kathy, your mic is open. Is there any other mics?
Sister Betty, thank you so much for having me on the show. Actually, I want to yield my time to Kathleen Grisby. She's in Colorado, and this young lady, the whole world needs to know her story. So, again, I thank you so very much for having us on tonight, and please let give Kathleen time to share what she's dealing with right now at the present. Thank you.
You text me the last four digits of anybody else that you've invited. I'll open their mics for them to speak as well. Go ahead.
Her last four digits is 3014.
Thank you. Go ahead, Sister Kathleen.
This is Kathleen Grisby calling from Douglas County, Colorado, one of the wealthiest counties in the country, and where conservatism, Trumpism, and white supremacy reign. Before sharing my story with the audience, I would first like to extend my gratitude to Ms. Belinda Parker Brown of Louisiana United International, my mother, Mary Regina Grisby, who is a victim of a very serious fraudulent conservator and guardianship, and I joined about 4 weeks ago. And Ms. Parker Brown is doing everything she can to help my mother and I. I'd also like to give recognition to Rick and Terry Black of Seer Justice in Cornelius, North Carolina. The Blacks have worked tirelessly before the Free Britney Spears movement ever started to help victims like my mother, who is enduring estate trafficking, fraudulent conservator and guardianship, neglect, and abuse. And the Blacks have been thrown under the bus by the Free Britney movement in Los Angeles, California. And the Blacks have freed several of the elderly victims who are members of the Free Britney movement in Los Angeles. And they are blackballing Rick and Terry Black, and it's a disgrace. And I want to give recognition to the Blacks for Rick Black, for facilitating my introduction to Ms. Belinda Parker Brown at Louisiana United International. I participated and listened to a Senate Judiciary Committee subcommittee meeting this afternoon at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The topic was toxic conservatorship, the need for reform. The subcommittee on the Constitution heard a number of witnesses, many of whom really didn't address the true issues of fraudulent conservator and guardianship regarding the elderly. My parents were interracially married, my father Black and my mother white. My father was one of the first Blacks to receive a PhD from the University of Colorado at Boulder. The racism that he and my parents endured while he was writing his dissertation in the 60s was so bad that someone tried to blow up their Volvo. They could not live in Boulder, and they had to live in Westminster. My father had to commute sometimes 2 to 3 hours one way to meet with his advisor. My father had access, as many of these speakers have discussed this evening, and about the disparities in healthcare between Blacks and white Americans in this country. My parents were affluent, hardworking Americans who saved and invested their money wisely. My father was originally from the 5th Ward of Houston, Texas, had a lifelong issue with asthma and also heart disease. To just show how bad the racial disparities are in the state of Colorado, where less than 8% of the population is black, father was not even given a COVID test. And he died of COVID in cardiac arrest on December 17th of this year. My mother and father did not even have an opportunity to say goodbye to each other when he died. I was the heir to my parents' trust and estate and my mother's power of attorney, financial and medical. My brother found out that he was not on the estate documents and accused me of being an abuser of the elderly and that I had killed my father. He leveraged these allegations against me from London, along with the social worker where my mother was in rehabilitation, Holly Creek, in Centennial, Colorado. They then, when my mother refused to turn over her medical and financial powers of attorney to my brother, they then turned me into Michelle Kane of Adult Protective Services in Douglas County, who then got a corrupt white-collar crime group under the protection of District Court Judge Clay Hurst to have my mother placed in a fraudulent conservator and guardianship. My mother is fighting for her life, and I'm trying to save her life. They are in the process of medicating my mother quickly to end her life. The conservator illegally locked me out of our home that I had rights to in May, leaving me in the streets. I'm now in a homeless shelter. I have been separated from my mother through a temporary protection order that is going to be made permanent. Roberto and Jennifer Berry, neighbors across the street, who are an interracial couple who have been protecting my mother, also her home and personal belongings, heirlooms, and antiques from corrupt.
We need to know what you want us to do. The time is running out, so we need to know what you want us to do.
I think what we need to do here is get your information, call us after the program is over, and I would quickly refer you to the Lawyers Guild. Michael Smith, Law and Disorder, to see if there's a lawyer in Boulder or wherever you are to deal with this. I got the drift. There is much corruption, and you can't believe in the law. You can't trust the law. And so I would suggest that after this program, you give me a call and we will work from there. Is that fair?
Yes.
Hello?
Brother Raph, this is Sister Belinda. Kathleen, just thank you, Brother Raph. That is excellent. And thank you so much for giving us this time, because she right now, her whole life is in shambles. She's being devastated. She's also due to, they want to lock her up and put her in jail in November. So she needs a lawyer that can help her and her mother. Her mother, she had a recording that she was going to play from her mother screaming and crying out for help. So we're not able to do that, but we will definitely get in touch with you after the show. Thank you so much, Brother Raph and Sister Betty. We love you all. Giving us this opportunity meant a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Information and action. Sister
the New York Times about 5 years ago did a documentary on elder abuse as it applies to exactly what this caller is talking about. But it's about action. We've got to fight. We can't let them break us down. We've got to fight. And everything that she's saying is totally credible. This is a capitalist country. And the wolves will feed on you if you're not strong enough to fight them back. I want to go to Sister Nellie and Brother Joel. Will you please hang in there? Your mic is open.
Hello, Sister Betty. I know that you're short on time, and I'll just be very quick. I'm sure some, if not all, of your listeners are familiar with the Yahoo report that was detailed the various schemes of the U.S. government from Secretary of Defense Mike Pompeo, under Donald Trump, and their various scenarios about which included the assassination and murder of Julian Assange. This report came from Yahoo, not a left formation. And I know there are people who love to beat up on the left, but they have nothing to say about the right wing. The left is non-existent in this country for the most part, and people should understand that. Anyway, back to this various scenarios that the CIA and the FBI came up with. One was they had imagined that Russia would try to spirit Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy. And if so, one scenario explicitly discussed, even with Trump, was if the Soviets, if not the Soviets, but if Russia attempted to spirit Julian Assange out of the Ecuadorian embassy, they would do it by car. And they, meaning the U.S. and British intelligence, would engage in a gunfight with the Russian agents attempting to spirit Assange out of the country. And if the gun battle failed, what they would do, they would have a helicopter waiting at the airport, and the helicopter would fire on the plane that was spiriting him away. Other scenarios included murdering him in the Ecuadorian embassy, and all of this, again, is from Yahoo News, not the left, not Counterpunch, not from China, not from anyone, but in fact, Yahoo News, extensive interviews with military personnel, with reporters, and with an assortment of characters who have testified to this, who reported this, rather. And in fact, high-level whistleblowers who were in those meetings that included the presence of Donald Trump. This is enough of a scandal for the British High Court to, one, not send Assange to the U.S., and two, which is really number one, is to free him. The scam, and again, we have to discuss identity politics. There is the left that's involved with the very scandalous situation here, is how does the left handle internal dissent without the markings of COINTELPRO being all over the place? The point about the various scenarios of murdering, kidnapping Julian Assange is that the American government is a criminal enterprise. It has a permanent war economy that President Dwight Eisenhower informed us of. Hello?
We're listening with bated breath. Oh, continue, please.
President Eisenhower informed us of warned us of the military-industrial complex. And what we are seeing is the criminal enterprise of exceptionalism that is even more difficult to sell to the rest of the world. These are crooks stabbing each other in the back, as was the case of the 12 nuclear submarines that the U.S. snatched from under France negotiations in their $100 billion deal with Australia. And we know that this is a pivot toward China, but it's not going to work. And I was listening to Richard Wolff the other day, because we know that Evergrande, the Chinese real estate company that collapsed, which I thought rather shocking, was 25% of China's GDP. But it's, as Richard Wolff, the economist, said, this is nothing but a bump in the road. And in fact, the construction will go on. People are upset, naturally. But we have to remember, $300 billion pales in comparison to the $600 billion of Lehman Brothers that collapsed in 2008. So again, the ruling class strategy of divide and conquer is based on identity politics, because if you are for the few as opposed to the many, what are we going to come up with? It's your issue, someone else's issue, this issue, when we should be talking about what Brenda Parker Bowles talked about, which is so interesting to talk with her, is that we have to come together, which is what this radio program is. We are dealing with a criminal enterprise. Its currency, its fiat, is in trouble, because we know in 1971 it was Richard Nixon who took the U.S. off the gold standard. So what we are experiencing here every day, it's the printing of paper that is not backed up by anything other than the feds, who will go on forever printing dollars that is not backed up by an exchangeable mode of how you can exchange this fiat, which is in gold, which is what Russia has done, which is what China has done, and which is what England is doing. No wonder they went into Venezuela. They weren't concerned about the government. They were concerned about getting their hands on the gold, as it was in Syria, as it was in Iraq, as it has been their wholesale theft based on their, quote, exceptionalism, which is really the emperor with no clothes that the whole world can see, the whole world has detected, and no one is falling for the lies of patriarchy and racism, the two pillars of their exceptionalism. It's going to come down. It may take some time, and the whole world is rising up against the lockdown because of the pandemic, because they know that this has become a method and a strategy for social control. People are correct about that, but also be correct about who and what entity you are blaming is not the left, because the left does not exist here in the U.S. The left is collaborators with the Democratic Party. And if anybody believes that Joe Biden is left and is not a racist, remember, this is the man who delivered the eulogy for one of the most notorious southern races, and that was Thurman. That's what
Charles
he did. And he is proud, he, meaning Biden, is proud of the fact that Thurman called him my son. That is this man's story. So
wow.
I don't want to hear anything about the bad people under Trump, the bad white people being led by Donald Trump and the good white people under Joe Biden. If they
wow.
are, if we're talking about if we're talking about this colonial settlers' history and mentality, you can't separate the so-called good white folks from the bad white folks. They all
well,
fall in there somewhere. And the thing is that are we working to defeat the many, or are we working to defeat the few? We have to think about
Kelly,
that in terms of building alliances. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and I must apologize to Professor Joel Meyer, who always has something. Get your notebooks out when Joel comes on, and we're going to have to hold our thoughts of Joel till next week. And Joel, you will be up first, and as I say to everyone, get your notebooks out because Joel, Professor Joel Meyer, has a lot to talk about.
I want to ask people, Nelly, would you tell people where else they can hear you? Where else can they hear you?
Well, Black Agenda Radio is down now. And thank the sister for the Dolores for the report on kidneys, because that was Glenn was on dialysis. But they can hear me, hopefully, on What's Happening.
That's what I hoped you'd say. Joel, your mic is open. Just give us a word of parting and what we can anticipate next week.
Yeah, well, I guess two things to comment on what was mentioned in the show and what became thematic. The first of all, the question of Cuba and the pandemic and the Cuban medicine, it's not just that they have better and more dedicated doctors, because there are many dedicated doctors in the U.S., but they're organized into a herd like most other trades and professions in the United States, which give an almost monolithic line that cover up everything that's going on. We have to focus on the fact that this pandemic was created by Dr. Fauci and others in his orbit under something which Obama had temporarily banned, the old and called gain of function, meaning enabling viruses that never infected humans to infect them. Fauci has been around since the days of AIDS germ warfare, and he's still around doing the same thing, covering everything up, whereas Cuba has real doctors and a real medical profession that are not devoted to political schemes, profiteering, or anything like that. Blames the whole thing. They're real doctors, and here we have a profession organized into themes. And then the other thing about the U.S. money, the U.S. is now on the point of canceling its debt ceiling. And that means that the United States is going to default on its debts around the world, hundreds of billions of dollars, and it looks like it's coming into another major catastrophe that they're going to try to make regular people pay for instead of the racketeers that have bankrupted the country.
Well, we're going to continue with this next week, Joel. We're going to lead off with that, but I'm betting that the Democratic Party will fold and say that they folded to save the working class what little bit the Republicans allowed them to have. Thanks again, and thank you for all of you joined in. We are sorry there were so many people who had so much to say, but we will give you more of the same next Tuesday night. Please dial in, my brother.
And don't forget Comrade Don Fitz's book, The Cuban Healthcare, The Ongoing Revolution. And we want to give a special shout out to everyone who spoke tonight. Thank you.